Our third case, Sanchez and Daniels v. Carrasco. Mr. Carrasco.
May it please the Court. My name is John Carrasco, representing myself and my law firm today. I'd like to begin by noting that at least two of the issues that we presented today appear to be issues that haven't been addressed before, at least directly, by any Seventh Circuit case law. Consequently, in the absence of particular Seventh Circuit case law to guide the actions of an attorney in connection with a multiple-party representation, it is inherently unfair for a district court to impose an 80% penalty with respect to the compensation earned by the attorney in the context of that representation. Furthermore, it is inherent in the context of an attorney's actions as a member of the bar to remember a fundamental tenet that's discussed in the context of the Rules of Professional Conduct, the preamble, that is, that a lawyer's duty to society is greater than his duty to any one client. The exceptions and the rules kind of show this. The exceptions relating to attorney-client privilege. If you know that your client's going to engage in an activity of fraud or illegality, you have a duty to disclose. There's an inherent duty in the rules also not to do harm to third parties, and it goes on and on. So while it's very true that an attorney is a fiduciary, it's also very true that the fiduciary activity of an attorney is circumscribed by his oath. Under the Florida Bar oath that I read every month in the Florida Bar Journal, it says that, you'll do your job without regard to lucre. Lucre, as you're aware, is money. The result that I seek here today is actually going to result in us even perhaps forfeiting the fees that were awarded below. That is, if this court finds that there was, in fact, violation of ERISA Section 406-409 and Prohibited Transaction 2003-39, which I might add my opponents do not touch at all in their brief. If the court were to find that that were a reasonable basis for the objections that came through below, then the court also has to find that that good faith basis negates the findings of Judge Kennelly that there was no good faith basis upon which to proceed. Judge Kennelly, in his opinion, stated that this high-minded approach appeared too late for him. It appeared too late for him. That is, you didn't say it was illegal until it was too late. Your Honors, I didn't know that alerting the court or other lawyers to an illegality in the law had a time frame, had a time limit. And to the extent that there is any implication that what Judge Kennelly said was a high-minded, apparently post hoc justification for actions that took place below, I would suggest to your honors that not only was Judge Kennelly not correct in his assessment of what went on, but he also made a mistake in the record. He said it wasn't raised except in the context of the last sentence of a particular motion that was filed. And in fact, your honors, if you look at the record, this particular matter was raised. Illegality was raised first when the motion for preliminary injunction was filed in the case. Second, at docket 349, page 33 to 34, the judge failed to reflect on page 31 and 32 of the same record where the ERISA violations were discussed. At docket 352, he denied that objection, in essence denying the assertion of illegality. We raised the ERISA illegality issue at preliminary injunction, page 12, 13, 21, 20, and 21. The prohibited transaction issue was squarely raised in the memorandum in support of motion to allow disclosure of settlement agreements, docket 354, page 3, 9, and 10. Now, that factual mistake by Judge Cannelli is completely understandable in the context that a lot of trees were cut below. The record is big, and to go through each and every memorandum might have ultimately excused him from reading each and every allegation below. But it's also extremely important to remember that this was not a post hoc justification. And even if it were, I wish to reiterate that a lawyer's duty to tell the court and to tell other people what's going on, which violates ERISA Section 406 self-dealing provisions, which are articulated and enforced by Prohibited Transaction 2003-39, which is the fifth short appendix to our main brief. It is clear, without doubt, that the Department of Labor's position is that when you negotiate a settlement on behalf of yourself, and in the context of an ERISA case where you have alleged breach of fiduciary duty, that there are at least two requirements: that you get an independent third party to look at that settlement to make a decision with respect to whether it was fair or reasonable, and secondly, and more importantly, that there be no ancillary benefit to other sorts of individuals or entities associated with the people alleged to have violated the law. In this particular case, the entire settlement agreement was meant to aid the fiduciaries who, in fact, were accused of breaches time after time in connection with this case. And then secondly, and more importantly, to aid strike suit litigation that had been filed in the middle of the case, which Jack Daniels, in his deposition, which is attached to the record, said, quote, unquote, led them to settle this case. In essence, the settlement agreement was meant to get rid of the Philadelphia litigation filed against both of us, and also to, in the process, to set me up for the lawsuit that now has continued for years in Philadelphia. Should lawyers be allowed to do that? Should lawyers be allowed to use strike suit litigation in another jurisdiction as a tool to engage in settlement negotiations? It's an extraordinary situation. But I'd like to pose to you a hypothetical with respect to multiple party representation. The ERISA claims in this case were not limited only to class claims, but ERISA Section 502, as implemented by the Russell case in the Supreme Court, mandates that the claim is a plan-wide claim. In essence, whether you like it or not, the day that you sign up for a class action or the day you become a plaintiff in an ERISA case, you are taking on other people's causes of action. There is an inherent institutional multiple-party representation in connection with signing a fee agreement or agreeing to do that sort of thing. But there are five people in this case who have been forgotten, and those are the employees of Sanchez and Daniels who were brought along for the ride. I want to pose to you the hypothetical that shows you the Hobson's choice. The hypothetical is this: what if Jack Daniels and Manny Sanchez decided that they did not like the deal a couple years later on, and somebody told them about Prohibited Transaction 2003-39? And Mr. Krizloff didn't tell them about it, as they all admitted down below. Nobody talked about the ERISA issues in the context of the settlement. Suppose that I had not raised that issue below. Is it malpractice? I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kresko. Mr. Pigor?
May it please the court, Counsel, my name is John Pegori. I represent Sanchez and Daniels. With me at counsel table is Manuel Sanchez, founding partner of the firm. We're asking this court to affirm the judgments of the district court. Regarding Judge Cannelli's judgment on the quantum merit claim, we believe the record does support Judge Cannelli's finding that Mr. Carrasco did violate Rule 1.2 of professional conduct. However, before we get to the issue of Mr. Carrasco's violation of the rules, Judge Cannelli considered all of the factors that the case law specifies for the trial court to consider in a quantum merit case. He made many findings of fact that support the judgment that $83,000 was fair, just, and reasonable, which support the trial court judgment before we even get to the issue of Mr. Carrasco's violation of professional rules. First, Judge Cannelli considered the time expended and found that Mr. Carrasco's reconstructed time records were completely unreliable and wildly inflated. Second, Judge Cannelli found that 1,000 to 1,200 hours was a rough estimate of the time Mr. Carrasco spent on the case. It was not a finding that that amount of time was reasonable or necessary for the work product produced. In fact, Judge Cannelli found just the opposite, that much of Mr. Carrasco's time was a waste of time and affirmatively counterproductive. Third, Judge Cannelli considered the result obtained for the client. Judge Cannelli found that at most, Mr. Carrasco contributed to an increased value of $133,000 for his client. Thus, the award of $83,000 represents 62% of the value he contributed. Fourth, Judge Cannelli found and looked at the extent to which Mr. Carrasco contributed to that result. He found that Mr. Carrasco never served as lead counsel, and he abandoned his client midway through the case. Fifth, Judge Cannelli considered that the strategic decisions that Mr. Carrasco advocated ultimately prejudiced Sanchez and Daniels by creating a mega case that he lacked the skill and resources to prosecute. Sixth, Judge Cannelli found that the time Mr. Carrasco devoted to class action issues did not benefit Sanchez and Daniels because the defendants did not settle out of contemplation of class action issues. All the other lawyers who looked at the case besides Mr. Carrasco thought class certification was problematic and unlikely. Seven, Judge Cannelli found that much of the time Mr. Carrasco devoted, he devoted to the fee dispute itself or to the attacks on the settlement, which were not properly considered as a quantum merit claim. In his brief on appeal to this court, Mr. Carrasco did not dispute any of these findings. Thus, before we even get to the issue of Mr. Carrasco's violation, the record fully supports Judge Cannelli's finding that $83,000 was the fair, just, and reasonable compensation to which Mr. Carrasco was entitled. Moving on to the violation, Judge Cannelli found that Mr. Carrasco violated Rule 1.2 of professional conduct by his opposition to his client's settlement negotiations and settlement agreement. That opposition caused Mr. Krizlov to expend over $90,000 in attorney time and costs.
How did that finding by Judge Cannelli affect his assessment that $83,000 was a proper compensation?
I think in the end, Judge Cannelli, it was one factor that Judge Cannelli considered, and in his opinion, it was the last factor that he considered. He went through each of the ones that I've suggested here. In fact, there were more.
If first you determine the value of the lawyer's services, and then if you want to punish him for misconduct, you would then subtract something, right? Because I understand how the violation of the... You mean the conflict of interest?
Yes, sir.
How exactly... Did Judge Cannelli think that that reduced... that that had an actual effect on his representation and reduced the value of it to you, or what?
What Judge Cannelli found...
Unclear.
What Judge Cannelli found, I think, is that the inherent conflict argument was not properly raised in the underlying case. And he didn't... The inherent conflict is a purported justification for what is an apparent violation of Rule 1.2. He did oppose his client's settlement. He did oppose his client's settlement negotiations. So, yeah.
Are you saying this didn't affect the $83,000?
I think Judge Cannelli found that that was all he was entitled to, and he considered the violations, and that was one more factor that just weighed on the finding that $83,000 was the most that he was entitled to. Particularly when you look at the value that he contributed. $133,000 was the value he contributed to the case, and Judge Cannelli weighed that factor and thought, gee, $83,000 is kind of a lot, but he did spend a considerable amount of time. We don't know how much. And we don't know exactly what he did because his time records were completely unreliable.
So I'm just puzzled by, I can see how obviously a conflict of interest can lead to diminished quality representation. That's the theory of why conflicts of interest are bad. But I take it from what you said that Judge Connelly didn't find that because of the conflict of interest, the value rendered was less than otherwise.
I think what Judge Connelly found is that the conflict of interest was not a legitimate argument that Mr. Koresko raised in this fee dispute. He did not credit it. Judge Connelly saw Mr. Koresko as a lawyer and he heard him as a litigant.
I thought it was Koresko's conflict of interest.
Koresko had a conflict of interest.
Right.
He says he had a conflict of interest. He says that he was representing the interests of the putative class. Judge Connelly said it was not a...
Maybe we're talking cross purposes. I was thinking of the conflict of interest, and here it is, having a majority interest in this firm that competed in providing these plans. Did that figure in Judge Connelly's decision?
In a footnote.
Just a footnote.
Yeah,
so he didn't use that to cut down the...
I really don't think he did. He mentioned Penmont in a footnote, and I mentioned that Mr. Koresko may have been motivated by his crusade to bring down his competitor. I don't think Penmont really played a factor in Judge Connelly's decision.
So you were talking about it, you were talking about his argument that that the class was being sold out.
Right.
His conflict of interest argument, not his conflict.
The one he presented just a few moments ago to this court. Judge Connelly found, as a matter of fact, that Mr. Koresko did not legitimately raise that argument. He didn't legitimately raise that argument because in the underlying case, he never sought leave of court to withdraw, or he never sought leave of court to represent the putative class. He never obtained leave of court to withdraw from Sanchez and Daniels. So he was acting on his own. All the case law he relies on, just final thought, Lazy Oil, Agent Orange, Corn Derivatives, emphasize the importance of trial court involvement when a conflict of interest appears in a class action suit. Mr. Koresko never got trial court involvement to come and deal with the inherent conflict interest that he now claims. Because he didn't get trial court involvement, he violated Rule 1.2, and that's why his inherent conflict argument was rejected as a matter of fact.
Well, in fact, Judge Connelly made affirmative findings on misconduct apart from the putative basis for the motion to withdraw. He made findings on Rule 1.2 and that there were violations that were consisting of the obstruction of the settlement and that sort of thing, as I understand the
record. Yes, Your Honor, that's right. He did.
So,
he did.
You know, apart from rejecting the conflict argument that was raised by Mr. Koresko, there was an affirmative finding that he violated the professional conduct rules in attempting to obstruct the settlement.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pigora.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Krislav?
Morning, Judge Bauer, Judge Posner, Judge Sykes. I have but a minute. I think Mr. Pigora has addressed the issues of Judge Connelly's exercise of exceedingly an exacting analysis, forbearance, indulgence. Mr. Koresko wasn't punished. He was adequately dealt with on his fee. My only issue here this morning is whether there was a legitimate RICO claim asserted against me and my firm for having entered into or for having acted as counsel for Sanchez and Daniels in effecting the magistrate-mediated settlement negotiations and bringing that to a settlement. I would assert that on the briefs it's clear that there is no RICO. Even if everything that he said was true, was alleged, whatever, it does not state a RICO count, A, because there was no continuity to any of this. It was a one-time settlement. Two, if that is a basis for a RICO allegation, then any time a lawyer enters into settlement negotiations for his client in a class action where all the rest of the class has left the building, he would subject him or herself to similar allegations. There is simply no basis for the RICO assertions here. If the court has any questions, I'll entertain them. Otherwise, I'll just sit down.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Krislav. Mr. Carmichael?
Good morning, Your Honors. Christopher Carmichael on behalf of the third-party defendants, Appalese. We believe that the district court's judgment should be affirmed in this case because Mr. Carrasco lacks both standing and there's a causation issue with his RICO claim. He seeks to redress an ERISA problem that affects other people, not him, the plan participants, and he does not have standing to challenge, as this court already ruled, the settlement in the underlying Daniels case. We therefore think that the judgment should be affirmed. Unless the court has any questions, I too will sit down.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carmichael. And Mr. Carrasco, does he have any time? 1 minute. Yeah.
Your Honors, a principal reason for the actions by Judge Cannelli below were that of some sort of a breach of an agreement to bring in trial counsel. Judge Cannelli overlooked Jack Daniel's own testimony in his deposition and the Rule 56.1 statement and the proposed findings of fact and conclusion of law, Record 224, that his trusted lawyer, Faye Clayton, recommended that two law firms not be contacted for the case back in February, a year or so before there was any entrance into the case of Mr. Krizloff, one of those lawyers being Mr. Krizloff. What is a lawyer to do? You're taking a recommendation or a client's recommendation not to talk to somebody when that somebody could be the person that could come into the case. It rings very hollow, but Judge Cannelli just simply overlooked it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Preston. Thank you to the lawyers for the other side.